Morning. We're happy to have you all in the courthouse, but we have a special welcome for students from Cedarburg High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. These students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. The program is sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. And we invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students get materials about the case, and they may engage in some activities around the case. They come for oral argument, and then after the second case, which is about 12 to 12:15, the students will meet with a justice who has been assigned that day to meet with them, and the discussion will be on the procedures the court uses to take and decide cases. Everyone is invited to join the students and the justice at that session. There is not going to be a discussion about the substantive issues of the case. Does anyone want a summary of the case we are about to hear? The marshal has summaries. It's easier to listen and understand the case if you know the facts and the issue of law. All right, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. It's Justice Crooks who has been assigned to meet with these students today.
Excitedly so.
Okay. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 08AP1546. Robert D. Conacher versus Robert S. Romano. Arguing for the Conachers is Attorney Stephen Sorensen. Counsel?
Madam Chief Justice, other honorable members of this court, I'm extremely pleased to be here today to appear before you on behalf of my clients, Robert and Ann Conacher. Mr. Conacher is personally present. Again, as the Chief indicated, my name is Attorney Steve Sorensen of Sorensen Law Office of Ripon, Wisconsin, and I'm joined here today by my associate, Emily Dinnigan. We are here today to look at what I consider to be two essential issues. Those issues arise out of the appeal of the summary judgment that was affirmed or the summary judgment that was affirmed in the court, trial court, that there existed certain lake property easement rights for the Conachers. There are two issues. The first issue is whether that summary judgment granted by the trial court correctly determined that purchasers of property with an access easement on a large inland lake can reasonably expect that the easement will include the ability to access and install a pier that would, of course, otherwise be allowed under Wisconsin law. The second issue is whether the Wisconsin statutes 30.131 and 30.133 apply in this case. Succinctly, the answer to question number one is yes. Because an access by easement to a large public body of water without the use of a pier is virtually no access at all. So the summary judgment granted by the trial court that found that pier rights are inherent in such an access easement is well-founded. Regarding the applicability of Wisconsin statutes 30.131 and 30.33, the answer is no. These sections were enacted after the conveyance of this easement and apply prospectively, so they are not active here they are not applicable here. Furthermore, the court asks us to address the case of Ellingsworth versus Squiggum, 195 Wisconsin 2nd, 142, and we would concur that that case does not apply in this case. And it does not apply for two reasons, which we will discuss. Secondarily, the court asked us to consider, in light of those two statutory sections, Wendt versus Blazek, 201 Wisconsin Appellate, 91, which we believe does control. Let me lay a little foundation. Bob and Ann purchased their home in 2004. When they purchased this home, just off the water, they also purchased an easement access to the waters of Green Lake. As indicated in the record, their purchase was predicated upon a recognition of Green Lake as one of the largest, deepest lakes in the state of Wisconsin. They purchased their residence with a full and complete understanding that it included a 20-foot access easement to Green Lake, the access which they believed guaranteed them access to the 7,300 inland lake, which offered fishing, boating, swimming, sailing, and the other activities generally associated with a body of water as large as Green Lake.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to say this at the outset, because this is the part that I need to have answered for me. Having been in the seat of the trial court judge trying to decide lake right issues, they're sticky and complex and oftentimes heated and require days and days and sometimes experts to testify. How can a judge basically just take judicial notice that you have the right to have a peer on a particular easement? And here's the real kicker for me. You got to explain to me how all this can be done at summary judgment in this case. That I'm just laying it on the line so that you can help me through that as you do your argument today.
Yes, I understand, Justice. And my response to that would be very succinct. Justice, the West Bend Lakes, and you know those. Judge McMonagle spent 60 years growing up on Green Lake. One of the other attorneys for the defendant, Attorney Lehner, I mean, that was in the record, was born and raised on the lake. Everyone that lives and works around Green Lake knows the type of lake it is. And the reality is we also, those of us that deal in inland lake practices, such as myself and such as Judge McMonagle did before he became a judge and has to deal with all the time, recognize that when one uses the terminology access easement on a lake, especially a lake that this is a cove, and we have to understand that this case, Byers Cove is this mucky, swampy little cove area. It's not the main body of the lake. There's nothing to do on this access other than get from that access into the main recreational, the 7,300 acres.
So you can't do that by kayak or by enjoying, you know, being down near the water or, well, you know, I've had cases where it's gone from anything from being able to operate a seaplane out of an easement to using their pier over the years, which really wasn't on the easement, but then when someone new bought the property, they wouldn't let them use the pier anymore, so then they wanted to build a pier that never existed. I mean, these are really oftentimes complex, fact-intensive issues that I'm stumbling a little bit with taking judicial notice that this must be for a pier.
And I understand clearly, Justice, because having practiced in all kinds of waterways, it's just, and I wonder if you're acquainted with the Flambeau River or the Brule River or some of these streams in Wisconsin that are no wider than this table. If you had an access easement onto that, one would assume, based upon historical use of the property, that that's an access for a canoe or for a kayak. On Green Lake, just as on Lake Mendota or Lake Wisconsin or Lake Winnebago, there are so limited times of the day you would ever take a kayak or a canoe out in that body of water, one, because it's so rough, two, because of the other traffic. That's not the kind of lake that historically is used for those kind of activities. It's used for major boating. It's used for fishing, water skiing, jet skis, It's that kind of a lake. It's what we refer to often as a water ski lake or, you know, a large recreational lake. Now, I would agree with you that there's lakes in Wisconsin where the easement would by its very nature mean put a kayak in, put a canoe in, but not Green Lake. In fact, if you took Silver Creek, which is the inlet to Green Lake, Silver Creek or Lake or Puckian River, which is another, Silver Creek's, yeah, the inlet, so is Puckian, those would be considered, if they had easements, easements to put in duck boats, because that's usually what goes in. And I know clients that have easements on the Fox River, which is right in the same distance. Again, you would never put a powerboat into the Fox River in Princeton, but you'd sure put one in Green Bay. And so you have to take the nature and the history of the water.
In Green Lake? Do people swim in Green Lake?
Not in Byers Cove. You would never swim in Byers Cove because the muck is, you'd step in it and you get sucked down. You wouldn't be in there. Yes, and that's why one of the reasons we've indicated that, that it's so easy for the court to understand in this case that when this easement was granted to access the main body of the water, because then that accesses County Park, which is the biggest swimming park. It accesses Hattie Sherwood. It accesses, interestingly enough, Norwegian Bay, which is the area where most boaters go to lounge on this large body of water and swim off the pier. See, or swim off the boat, deck boats or those kind of boats, pontoon boats. And you certainly would never take a kayak in there. You wouldn't take it, except maybe really early in the morning. I mean, I've kayaked on Green Lake, but if you're not off of there by 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, you better be a really good kayaker. Otherwise, you're going to learn how to swim. And that's what I mean when that's where I think the judge could take notice of that, because it is the unique nature of the lake. You'll understand, just as Justice Wilcox said in the case, and I know I have the citation here, in the Stosser case, he pointed out when he looked at this case, and the only time this court has looked at that case, that you have to look at the intent of the easement. And as he said in that case, there are many non-riparian landowners in Wisconsin with lake access similar to the present one. The rule of law validates lake access easement, protects the, here's the key, the clear expectations of the non-riparian landowner who has relied on that easement. And that's what I'm trying to say in this case. The resolution of this case simply goes to the nature, and that's why I believe that the judge in this case, Judge McMonigle, who has his experience on the lake, and also remember, the defendant's attorney, not our attorney, it wasn't myself or Ms. Dinigan that said that. It was the attorney Lehner who was representing one of the defendants that clearly pointed out and agreed to the judge that that's the kind of easement that one would expect on this kind of property. And there's a whole series of cases that were pointed out that tell you, Atkinson versus Menzel, which is 211 Wisconsin 2nd 682, that's another Court of Appeals case which says every easement carries with it an implication of the right of doing whatever is reasonably necessary for the full enjoyment of the easement itself. I mean, there's a whole series of these cases that were brief for you today that clearly point out that the purpose of this easement in this case was to provide access to the 7,300 acres of Green Lake, because that's the nature of the lake. And I hope that addresses your question, Justice.
Thank you.
I'm tempted to do that.
Counsel.
Yes,
ma'am. You've got a written document here, right? The easement.
Yes, ma'am.
This is on summary judgment and affidavits, right? Are there any issues of material fact that have to be tried? How do you interpret this document?
I apologize, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. How do you interpret this? I don't mean you interpret it. I mean, how does a judge interpret the document? You can look at the words alone. You can have evidence as to what the meaning is. You can look at the content
parties. Excuse me, Your Honor.
In summary judgment.
And I think we still have to go back to the court in Stosser for some type of guidance in that, or taking a look at the Wendt case for some guidance in that. And the whole series of cases, and I apologize for not giving the full cites, it's right in front of me, but I can certainly get them to you. What I'm trying to say to you is that in all those cases, ambiguity is not unusual on lake easements. I'm here to tell you, and I'm sure that you've experienced, and I know the court has, because if you look at the Stoser case, if you look at the Wendt case, they cite extensively cases where there were ambiguous easements. You remember in the WRA brief, it wasn't just Wisconsin. They went to Minnesota, Michigan, Ohio. It was characteristic of, and I'll politely say this because I'm one of them, it's characteristic of the Northwoods practice to simply say, you have a lake access easement. And then that leaves it in the terms and the conditions of what the court knows and understands. I mean, our trial courts have to be given the opportunity to take the facts that they know. They can't divorce themselves of that. And I think what was interesting about Judge McMonigal in this case and what he did was he solicited from the defendant's attorney justification for what he was believing and what he was saying. And he relied on the Supreme Court. His whole decision was predicated on the decision in the Stoser case as far as why he made that decision. Certainly, I could argue the other side, Justice, but I really believe that's in good conscience why it was done. And it's done for judicial expediency because the reality is we could have spent weeks talking about what goes on Green Lake. We could spend weeks talking about how many boats go on Green Lake, how big the lake is, what the nature of the lake is. But it was self-evident for everyone in the courtroom as to what goes on in Green Lake, just as it would be, I think, for many of you to look at your home lakes. If you looked at Lake Mendota and I asked you, you know, what's the general use of Lake Mendota other than around the university or some of the other smaller inlets, you'd say it's big major boats, it's large sailing boats, it's the nature of the lake. That's where I believe it can be done. And when you have ambiguous language, the court has pointed out, when you have ambiguous language, it's okay for this court, and that's been briefed both in our brief and it was briefed in the WRA brief, that this court has reached out and looked for the intrinsic facts and the extrinsic facts that allow the court to decide. And I really believe that's where it's at, and that's why the decision was made.
Mr. Sorensen, let me,
yes, Justice,
if I might interrupt you for a minute. When Judge McMonigal was making his decision, was there any consideration of the statutory sections that are now part of this case?
No, there was not.
I know that the parties agree that I think it's 30.133 doesn't apply, but you have a real disagreement here as to 30.131. And you've said, well, the easement predates it, therefore it doesn't have any applicability. Now, when I read your brief, I thought your argument was more extensive than that. It almost seemed like an argument in regard to whether or not it would be constitutional to apply that particular statute to the situation here. Do you want to amplify that at all?
Yes, I would. I'd love to do that, Justice, because I believe there's a four-prong analysis that has to take place when you look at 131. And again, I'm referring here to statute Section 30.131, especially Parent 1, because that's the relevant one that has been brought forth by the court. I think the four prongs are this. First point, there is a salient point, and that is the question of whether the defendants have standing. We believe the defendants in this case, the Romanos, do not have standing to challenge the installation of the pier under 30.131. because Wisconsin Statute 31.31 addresses a possible, and I emphasize the word possible, a possible enforcement action by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources of the state. As Judge Nettesheim pointed out so clearly in the appellate decision in Wendt, the issue here is not whether the pier was unlawful under Section 30.131. That is a matter for the Department of Natural Resources. The second point that I would like to point out, well, first of all, before I finish that, I want you to understand, too, there's nothing in that statute that creates a private right. There's nothing in that statute that indicates that there's a private right that arises under that statute. And if you go back to statutory construction under Section 990 in the applicable cases that have looked at 990, you will know that unless that's they're specifically giving a private right, there is no private right because there was not a common law right to prevent a pier once you had given an easement. The second reason I think 30.131 does not apply. And that's because if you take a look at it, the issue is not ripe. There is no pier there, and 30.131 only refers to removal of a pier or a pier being constructed illegally.
Counselor, I thought that when the action was started, there wasn't a pier because the defendants, Romanos and maybe the Nelsons, too, had taken down the pier that your clients put up. But I thought, according to what I read, that after you prevailed at the circuit court level, then the pier went back up. Was it taken back down after the Court of Appeals, or we're just going back and forth? Or
no, Justice.
I know it comes out in the winter, so it's probably not there today. But.
No. It comes out every fall anyway. But,
yep.
But no, it did come out because when the Court of Appeals made its decision, I instructed my client that although we could argue that we had some rights, that wasn't worth it, take it out until we resolve the dispute, and that's what happened.
Okay. Thank you.
And it's very important to know that in the two times that you've cited, Justice, that the pier was in the water, no Department of Natural Resources action was taken. There were no complaints filed. There was no contact to my client by the Department of Natural Resources. No state action. And basically, Chapter 30 is a state action statute. It was created under the public trust doctrine, which we have no dispute with in this case, by the way. We recognize that any pier that would be built by the Conachers must abide by the terms of Chapter 30. The question isn't that today.
The question is what? Not that today? I didn't hear you.
Yes, that's what I said, Justice Bradley. The question is not that today. Today's question is whether or not they have pier rights, not how the pier is going to be constructed, because there's lots of hurdles you have to go over to construct a pier under Chapter 30. My client recognizes he would have to go through or they would have to go through those hurdles.
If 30.131 does apply, how is it possible to meet D, E, and F? How can anyone get over those hurdles in your fact situation? D is the pier has been placed seasonally in the same location
okay.
at least every 4 years since the written easement described in paragraph A was recorded. How can your client begin to satisfy that?
Well, number one, it doesn't apply, but let's, for sake of argument, say it does. And there's two reasons I want to go over before I quit why it doesn't apply, because I think they're very salient. But answering your question, I think you have to look at the fact situation here, too. Remember what the facts told you. The predecessor entitled to Conacher had access to a rental pier on the rest of the access lot. In other words, you have a 50-foot access lot, 20-foot belongs to Conacher by easement. He's not a riparian owner. He's only a riparian right holder, which is very important if you distinguish the Ellingworth case, because that talked about owners. But what's important here to recognize is that person could walk down this easement and go onto a pier that was being rented at $150 a month or a year. That's a whole lot cheaper than building a pier. So they had the best of both worlds. So there was no reason to build a pier. It wasn't until Mr. Conacher came along that easement right was suddenly taken away and saying, not only were we not going to rent you a pier like we did your predecessor entitled, but now we're going to prevent you from utilizing the easement rights that you do have. So, you know, that's a catch-22 that you have inherent in the statute. But I think it's important to recognize that the statute clearly points out that if you read the introductory language to 131, it refers you back to 133. It says notwithstanding. So what 131 is it's an exception to 133, because notwithstanding means despite. And if you study statutory construction says it has to be prospective. It cannot be retrospective unless it says it's retrospective. And if you read the language, and statutory construction says you cannot ignore the language that says notwithstanding 30.133, that immediately takes you to the language of 133, which is the controlling statute, because 130 Or 30.131 is an exception because it says despite or notwithstanding. So it becomes the exception to the main statute under statutory construction, which means that 1994 is the controlling year because 133 specifically says it's retrospective from April 9, 2004.
Except sub A of 30.131 specifically references December 31st, 1986, the owner of the riparian land or owner's predecessor in interest entered into a written easement that was recorded before December 31, 1986. How do you get around that?
That's one of the four conditions. But before you even get there, Justice, you have to read the statute from the top down, which says, notwithstanding 30.133, which is the controlling statute then, this is the exception to 30.133. That statutory construction that has been determined by this court and is in the statutes under chapter 990 of the Wisconsin statutes. And it's for those reasons that I basically, you know, have said to the court that I believe, number one, I think the trial court was correct when they granted the easement right, because that's what easements on Green Lake mean. When you have access to the water, that's what it means on Green Lake.
Counselor, you said that you had a four-prong analysis on 31.31, and so far you've given us three. I want to hear the fourth one.
The fourth one goes to the statement that if you – excuse me, I'm just going to take a breath. The fourth prong to that goes to what was in the – if you read the – I'm sure you did – the WRA brief, mm-hmm. because they talk about the concept of what this was intended to do, what the purpose of the statute was. It's to eliminate pyramiding, which was a common practice. And that, if you read the statutory history, that's why you've got the tieback to 30.133, because that was the purpose of 133, was to get rid of this pyramiding concept that was going on. And so they pulled the existing statute. In fact, if you worked at the Ellingsworth case, in there's a footnote number three. It's real interesting. It says this case will have very little precedential value because there's a new statute. And what that is saying is, what the court was saying in that instance, is they're saying because they added the language, the only language they added was notwithstanding 30.133. That's the only language they added. Suddenly the decision in that case has very little precedent because you've changed the statute, which is prospectively correct, because if you look at 30.133, the purpose of 30.133 carries back into now 30.131, and 30.131, you all know, created nightmares, because we have two different
You can finish your sentence.
Okay. Because currently we had two different courts of appeal that were coming down with two different applications of 30.131. And it was, I think, incumbent on the legislature to try to clarify that, and they did it by making it prospective. And I really believe, although I can't climb in the heads of those legislators, that's what this is all about. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. Counsel representing Mr. and Mrs. Romano, Lisa M. Arendt, White Hirschbeck.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, as noted, I'm Lisa Arendt from the law firm of White Hirschbeck Dudek in Milwaukee. I represent Robert Romano and Francis Romano. Mr. Romano is in the courtroom today along with his son, Bill Romano. This case does indeed present some interesting issues, and the issues fall under two different issues in this case, high-level issues. The first one is whether an easement that is silent on the grant of lake access or riparian rights, it says nothing about piers. Indeed, it doesn't have the word lake access in it at all. A standard easement that is to be used across property to get it to a waterfront. When the easement is silent on what rights it grants, does that easement grant the right to build a pier in the lake? And the case law, as established by the Court of Appeals and by this court in the area of easements, and also in the area of lakefront easements, I believe is really pretty clear. The second issue, and I think it is the most complicated issue upon first encountering it, but is the simplest issue once you get through it, is the effect of the statute on situations like this, the statutes. The question that this court raised when it granted the petition for review was, what is the application, if any, of 30.131 and 30.133 in this case, which is a private dispute about the scope of an easement and whether it grants the right to build a pier or not? And the answer to that question is Section 30.131 most certainly applies and affects the answer to the question in this case. And the issue of whether a pier is authorized or not or would be allowed by law is necessarily part of a court's determination on the enforcement of the easement and the scope of the easement. Courts that encounter these issues could take these issues in either order. In this case, the circuit court decided simply the scope of the easement and determined that based upon the judge's understanding of Green Lake and his feelings about lakefront easements, that this easement must have included the right to build a pier. As Justice Ziegler raised, the judge took judicial notice and used those words in the summary judgment hearing that you wouldn't have an easement like this if it didn't include the right to build a pier. And as I hear the argument by counsel for the Conachers, I hear the argument that this court should issue a rule that easements that give you the right to walk across property to get to a large lake like Green Lake would be expected by anyone who has the easement to include the right to build a pier. What I hear is an argument that there should be a blanket rule as to interpreting these easements. And
Counselor, you said something when you started out that was something that I hadn't understood to be your position, and that you said that this is not a right of access to Buyers Cove.
Well, we should look at the language of the easement, and that's what I was referring to.
Where are we going to find that?
What did you say?
Where will we find the language?
Okay, it's a couple places. I'll point you to one. Let's see. Supplemental Appendix 198. That's the original grant of easement. To summarize the language, or to quote it, but in part, the language of the easement grants an easement 20 feet in width along the westerly side of lot number 3 of certified survey map number 289, ellipsis, extending from Orchard Avenue to Buyers Cove. The point that I was highlighting in my initial remarks was that language doesn't include the words access to a lake. It doesn't, as I heard the argument of the Conacher's counsel, the argument was this is a lake access easement. And in some of the cases, you see the use of the words for access to the lake or for ingress and egress to the lake. Or as in Stosser, it talked about using your easement for boating and swimming and kindred purposes. And in this case, you have an even plainer easement that has no indication that the easement is being granted to do something specific in the water. The easement itself is useful. For one thing, it gives the holder the right, as against the rest of the public that doesn't have the right, to cross private property to get to Buyers Cove. Second, there's no evidence of the original party's intentions or the original party's to the easement not being able to use the easement or the easement being intended to be used to build a pier. For 23 years, no pier was built on the easement, and the Court of Appeals found, as we argued, that was strong evidence that the intentions of the parties to the original easement did not include the right to build a pier on the easement.
Counselor, you know, I have a question about that. I don't know if it did or it didn't, but I look at the affidavit of Norman Nelson and Lawrence Nelson, and if you look in paragraph 9, It said, sometime prior to May 1st, 1990, your affiance constructed a pier on or close to the 20-foot easement for mooring their boat. Now, you know, at least it's not clear to me from this affidavit that there wasn't a pier built. It may have been a cooperative pier between the owners of the dominant estate and the serving estate, because the dominant estate holders at that time paid a license fee or a rental fee for the pier. But it certainly doesn't say there was never a pier built on there. To me, it looks like the Nelsons, who bought from the original common owners of both of these properties, weren't that clear about it. I'm looking at paragraph 9 in his affidavit, supplemental appendix, page 163. I realize they're not parties before us today, but they were parties at the lower court level, and they are current owners of the property and have been for a long time.
The evidence submitted by the Conachers was that the piers that were placed on that lakefront property were placed off of the easement and were adjacent to it, weren't actually on the easement.
Well, you know, I have a little problem similar to what Justice Ziegler has. This is summary judgment. And summary judgment, you don't weigh and decide evidence.
Right.
There's complaints on your side of the street that the judge took judicial notice of things that weren't in evidence, but this statement appears to me to be rather equivocal, and your brief argues that the easement is ambiguous, and in my view, just so you know where I'm coming from, and maybe you can help me get out of that position, when you have a written document and it's ambiguous, you send it back for trial on what was the intent of the parties who made the original easement.
And I agree, Your Honor, that the easement is, I wouldn't even say it's ambiguous. I would say it doesn't grant the right to allow a pier, and it doesn't grant any specific rights to do anything in the water because it doesn't say so. But the case law has held that similarly vague easements can give the right to build a pier or do other things if the intentions of the original parties were to allow a pier. In this case, the party that holds the easement has the burden of proof on summary judgment. They move for summary judgment. They have the burden of coming forward with evidence of the original parties to the easement, that those parties intended the easement to include the right to build a pier. And it's undisputed that at the time the original easement was granted, there was no pier on the property. And what Your Honor is raising is a question about whether a pier built in 1990 was on the easement or not.
Sometime prior to May 1st, 1990. It could have been built 10 years before. I mean, it doesn't say in the affidavit. But what caught my attention, it says a pier was built on or close to the 20-foot easement. Now, just because you've got a servient estate with an easement on it doesn't mean, unless that's what the easement says, that it's for the exclusive use of the dominant estate. You just can't use it for a purpose that's inconsistent with the rights of the dominant estate holder. So, you know, everybody could have been getting along just fine at that point in time, and they decide to build a cooperative pier on the easement. Later on in that same affidavit, it says that the pier was moved over and constructed clearly outside of the easement. I don't know. I have some problems with there being an awful lot of facts here to me, frankly.
Your Honor, that gives me a good segue or an escape route to discuss the statutes, because it's my view that this case is a good example of how a circuit court should approach these issues going forward. The case of Ellingsworth gives a good example in the more recent case that's included in our supplemental appendix. It's not only an issue of, did the parties intend their easement to include the right to build a pier? We can put that question aside for now. The question, I think the more compelling question and the easier question to answer once you muddle through the statutes is, even if they did grant the right to build a pier, is that grant, is that easement enforceable or not? Would the pier built by the Conachers be illegal under Chapter 30? And the Conachers' argument, the first argument they made on the statutory issues is that the Romanos don't have standing to raise whether the pier would comply with 30.131. I assume the argument is also that the Romanos don't have standing to argue that the pier would be illegal under Sections 30.12, 30.11 of the DNR statutes. And in fact, the Romanos, as any member of the public, have standing to raise these issues. There's a section of Chapter 30.294 that provides that any violation of Chapter 30 is a public nuisance, and that anyone, any person, can bring an action to enjoin a violation of the statute.
But that's not where we are today. Well, there isn't a claim for nuisance here, and so I don't. I mean, there we may be looking down the street to more problems. Who knows? But that's really not where we are today.
Well, I'm just answering the question of whether they're standing or not to raise this issue. And there is standing. They're standing also in the sense of this is a contract. If an agreement between private parties granting one party, granting from a riparian owner to a non-riparian owner the right to build a pier, if that right doesn't even, if there is no such right in the non-riparian owner in the first place under the case law and under the statutes, then that grant is unenforceable as a matter of law.
Oh, well, that's the question we're faced with. I mean, what
right.
The heck does this easement provide? You know, it's interesting because until you started talking today, I never thought you didn't think that there was access to the lake, because in your brief it talks about, well, they could take a canoe or a kayak. And when I read that, I thought, well, would your clients really prefer that they back their trailer every day down the 20-foot easement to put their boat in? And then you started saying, well, there's not really access. So I'm sorry, unclear.
Let me correct my miscommunication. There is the right to cross the property because of the easement, and there's the right to go in the water because every member of the public has the right to get in the water.
Okay.
And so this easement is valuable and useful even without the right to build a pier.
Okay, you so can, they could back their boat down there every day, their boat trailer, and
I don't
put
know
the boat in there?
I don't know if that's occurred, but that is one way to use an easement to put a boat in the water without a pier. I'm not originally from Wisconsin, so I don't know all of these things, but I've since been schooled on it. That is one way. Other ways are to put a kayak in, to put a rowboat in, to put a smaller boat that has a motor that you can just wade in and put. The argument really is we can't put a real big sailboat, overnight yacht, whatever, because we don't have the right to build a pier, but that isn't what the easement provides. But to go back to the statute, 30.131 was adopted to grandfather in certain piers that built by non-riparian owners. But for 30.131, those statutes would be illegal. The case law and dating back to 1901 is very clear that only riparian owners have the right to build a pier in a lake bed. The lake bed is held in trust by the state for the public. The issue of whether private parties can agree amongst themselves that the other will be granted the right to build a pier is necessarily must necessarily be decided in light of the power of the state and the laws about who can build a pier and who can't. It's not the right answer in this situation to say this is an issue for the DNR and is an issue for a later date. Because if the pier in the first place is not legal and couldn't be built by this non-riparian owner, and this pier does not meet 30.131, there's no dispute that it wasn't built every 4 years from the inception of the easement. It doesn't meet 30.131. It's not a grandfathered pier. Therefore, it would be an illegal pier because non-riparian owners cannot build a pier as a matter
well,
of law.
Riparian proprietors can build them under 30.13. Are they the same as a riparian owner? I couldn't find any definition of those two terms. Riparian owner and riparian proprietor are both used in 30.13, which is the regulation of wharves, piers, and so forth.
There's been case law holding that means the same thing. I think it was the Cassidy case.
Yeah, I read the Cassidy case.
And the Cassidy case is the reason the legislature adopted 30.131. At the time they adopted 30.131 in 1989 or 90, one of the proposals was to also define a riparian owner to include a person who holds an easement.
Right.
And that amendment was rejected and not adopted. And so the only thing that remains is 30.131 that the legislature described in the legislative history as grandfathering in certain piers that meet the requirements of that statute. If your pier doesn't meet those requirements of 30.131, then it is then it, as a matter of law, it's illegal. It can't be placed in the lake bed. It doesn't matter whether the DNR brings an enforcement action or not. It's still illegal. The power over the lake beds is held by the state, and the only way to have the right to build a pier is if you have a permit to do so or you're authorized by the statutes to do so. And in this case, the only avenue in to get the right to build a pier as a non-riparian is 30.131. If you don't meet those requirements, then as a non-riparian, you don't have a right as a matter of law to build a pier, and your pier would be illegal. So for that reason, under the statutes, in this case, the Conokers don't have the right to build a pier on the property. Even if the easement were intended to grant the right to build a pier, that grant would be unenforceable because it's contrary to Chapter 30.
Well, is it, maybe it's a fact question about whether or not they met the requirements of 3131 that the DNR would have to ferret out in an action to declare the pier illegal. Because you agree it's the DNR that would have to make a determination that the pier is illegal subject to a complaint made to them.
No, I don't agree. I don't agree.
Well,
that's the only way that can be determined. It is illegal itself. And in this case does not need to be remanded on the issues of 30.131 because it's undisputed that the pier was not built on the easement every 4 years from 1983 when it was first granted. There's no argument that 30.131 was met, and the Conokers moved for summary judgment seeking the relief sought by their complaint. They did not come forward with any evidence that the pier was built every 4 years starting with 1983.
That may be true, but I don't think that was the focus of the trial court. That was really something we asked you all to brief for us, I think, when you came up here. And I don't know that there's been any interpretation of that statute about whether substantial compliance is sufficient and whether there are facts here to support substantial compliance. I mean, it just seems to me that we're a long ways away from being able to interpret the facts that support or don't support the statute.
Your Honor, the Conokers had the burden of proof to prove that the intentions of the original parties to the easement were that the easement would include the right to build a pier. And as case law that was cited in the briefs on summary judgment, the Wendt case and the Ellingsworth case and other cases like that, the evidence you must bring forward if you're the party seeking to get a court ruling that the easement includes the right to build a pier, you need to bring forward evidence of the original parties to the easement.
Right, and if you don't, your summary judgment motion is denied. But that doesn't mean the other side wins. The other side then has to bring forth undisputed evidence that there's no material question of fact before they can get summary judgment. It's not just you lose and you don't get a trial. You just lose on summary judgment. You got to go back and prove your case.
Your Honor, the Conokers, as the parties asking for the declaration that they can build a pier,
right,
they have the burden of proof.
Sure, they do, but then you have a trial, and that's how you satisfy a burden of proof. On summary judgment, there should be undisputed facts.
The defendants move for summary judgment, cross motions for summary judgment, and argued that the Conokers failed to prove that the original intentions of the parties to the easement was to allow the pier to build.
It's that side of the street that I think I see a lot of questions of fact. The affidavit that I pointed out to you is just one of those questions of fact. That is an affidavit of your client, or not your former client. I don't know if you represented them at the trial level or not,
we
but
didn't.
Just because the plaintiffs didn't submit enough to satisfy summary judgment, that just kicks them out of summary judgment. They got to go prove their case at trial. So when you're making a cross motion for summary judgment, you have the same obligation. There can be no material disputes of fact, or no disputes of material fact, I guess is the way it should be said. And I'm pointing out to you a couple of things that I find at least troublesome, and I think you agree the easement itself is ambiguous. So, you know, I don't know what you do with all of that, but
well, Your Honor, that this case being in the Supreme Court, having granted this case, and I agree, having muddled through all the statutory issues, the public trust doctrine analysis, and the historical case law on building piers, I agree that these are interesting, important issues.
Well, they are.
And whether we would, of course, prefer that the Court of Appeals be affirmed and that the case be remanded with orders that summary judgment be granted in favor of the Romanos.
Sure.
But putting that aside, the court, what we would ask the court to rule, what issue, what ruling this court should make that would be of assistance in our case and every other case going forward, is how should circuit courts approach these issues of when it's a pier and an easement. Mm-hmm. The Stotzer case, for example, the Stotzer case specifically didn't have a pier issue because the easement holder withdrew that, didn't make that argument. And so Stotzer, the broad language that riparian rights can be granted by easement really only relates to the argument in Stotzer, which was we had the right to cross the property and get to the water.
Right, I agree.
And that's what we have here. We have an easement. They have the right to cross the property and get to the water. Mm-hmm. The 30.133 was adopted to essentially reverse Stotzer's broad holding. But it also retains Stotzer's holding on its facts, that you can transfer the right to cross the property to get to the water. That easement is enforceable and allowed. 30.133 has a prohibition of transferring riparian rights by easement, including the right to build a structure in the water for easements after 1994. The 30.131 itself, that statute was adopted in 1989/90, and that statute does indeed govern easements that came before it, because the statute is described by the legislature and it has the effect on its face of grandfathering easements that would otherwise be illegal. The law was quite clear prior to 30.131 that non-riparian owners have no right to build a structure on a lake bed, and conversely, only riparian owners may build a structure on a lake bed. That was very clear.
Counselor, I think that the legislative history I read said that this was a significant change in what had been the past practices in Wisconsin, because routinely there were pier rights that were presumed to be on these easements. And I thought that the statute was to stop all the back lot development, which was causing apparently an overcrowding on lakefronts. And I thought that that's what it was. So I don't think the law was, quote, very clear that you couldn't build a pier on an easement before the statute. I think that's what the statute was designed to cabin just a bit.
The 30.131 says that a pier built by a non-riparian owner won't be held to be unlawful if it meets certain requirements.
Sure.
And it only applies to piers that were, or not to piers, to easements that were granted prior to December 31st, 1986. And so any easements granted after that date don't fall within the statute. Easements before that date fall within the statute if they meet all the criteria of the statute. But the 30.131 affects a change in the sense that it grandfathers and allows piers built by non-riparians, when previously the case law was that non-riparians don't have the right to build a pier. Under 30.11, 30.12, or 30.13, only riparian owners have the right to build a pier. And if it's built by a non-riparian, it's technically illegal. The statute 30.131, I take it that many piers in Wisconsin, small piers on lakes all over the state, may be built by an easement holder, and they may technically be illegal under Chapter 30, and that these easements may or may not meet 30.131. And over the years, the parties use the easement amicably, the piers used amicably, but the fact is, the easements built by a non-riparian are illegal, and they became legal if they meet the criteria of 30.131. And that's why the legislative history refers to 30.131 as a grandfathering, because the case of Cassidy and DeNava really highlighted the reality of the law, which people I suspect were ignoring in their practical lives on lakes, that, you know, if you're not a riparian owner, you can't build a structure. And as a practical matter, the DNR has limited resources, and whether it acts upon these small piers in between private parties is a question, but it doesn't answer the question as to whether the pier is illegal or not. If the pier is illegal, and it's clearly established by Chapter 30 that if it doesn't meet 30.131, then under the public trust doctrine, a non-riparian can't build a pier. The bottom line of this case is that private parties cannot take it upon themselves to agree to allow one to build a pier in a lake bed. The lake bed, and this is unlike many other areas of law like zoning, building houses, and things like that, the lake bed itself is held in trust for the public by the state. And the right to build a pier is only conferred to riparian owners, and even they can only build a pier if the legislature has granted them that right or if they have a permit from the DNR. In this case, the Conachers couldn't get a permit from the DNR because they're not a riparian owner. This court should tell circuit courts that they should decide the statutory issue, the 30.13 issue, as part of the analysis as to whether an easement grants the right to appear. Because 30.131, if you don't meet it, then the issue is resolved and it doesn't matter whether the party's intent was to allow a pier or not. In this case, to say that it's an issue for the DNR down the road or in reality, that would mean that the Romanos would have to bring an action to enjoin the violation of Chapter 30. And as a practical matter, and as contract law is applied in other areas, if your contract grant is unenforceable, then the court should not enforce it. And the analysis in this context of whether the grant is unenforceable is determined based on Chapter 30 and the case law thereunder. The final point, I think I'm probably running out of time, or I'll talk till it turns red, but the notwithstanding word in 30.131, I saw that too and I wondered what notwithstanding 30.133 and then you have 30.131. My first response to that is that 30.131 was adopted well before 30.133. So the notwithstanding language can't have an effect on the application of 30.131 on this easement because 30.131 applies to it, 30.133 doesn't. Putting that aside, the notwithstanding 30.133 language is in the statute simply because, or could be said to be in the statute simply because it's telling you that put aside 30.133. 30.131 is establishing a grandfathering of certain piers that are not illegal if built by a non-riparian. 30.133 certainly says you're prohibited from transferring an easement or transferring riparian rights by an easement. And so that prohibition seems clear, absolute, and without any exception except for the right to cross the land. The notwithstanding 30.133 language in 30.131 makes clear that 30.131 easements that satisfy that statute are legal and will be allowed, and that the prohibition of 30.133 has no application on those that category of peers.
Council, how many back lots are there that have this easement?
I believe there's seven others. That was one factor, I think, considered by the Court of Appeals as just another piece of evidence why the facts in the record do not support the conclusion that the original parties intended the easement to allow the building of a pier.
As I have read these cases, there on these easements, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that they seem to me to be, if not all, predominantly summary judgment cases.
Like Wendt or Ellingsworth?
Wendt. Won't go through them all. Let's see what my next one is. Strasser mm-hmm. was that. And you got, it's been a long time since I've looked at this, but you got parole evidence rules mm-hmm. about going behind a contract.
Right.
And a deed, or the easement here is a kind of contract.
Right.
Relating to real estate. And the Conachers had to prove on a summary judgment. They only had to establish a prima facie case. This is not preponderance of the evidence or... So my question to you, as I've listened to the questions of my colleagues, is tell me why you think this case in a deed that is not clear on its face, because it is silent, why it can be handled on summary judgment rather than a trial on intent, and where the parole evidence rule comes in.
This can be handled on summary judgment, because if the party seeking to have the easement held to
right.
allow the right to appear, comes forward with evidence, like in Wendt and other cases, that the original parties to the easement had a pier on it, they put it on every year for so many years, and therefore the intent of the parties, based on the facts and the conduct of the parties, establish an intent to that the easement will include the right to build a pier. In this case, this is a little different. The Conachers had the burden of proof, and when they moved for summary judgment that the scope of the easement was intended to include a pier, they put in evidence of their own understanding and their own expectations. But that evidence is not relevant at all. And your question, Your Honor, brings that to my mind. The Conachers bought their property in 2004 and built the first pier in 2006. This easement was granted in 1983. So, and the Court of Appeals held this as well. Conachers' evidence about their intentions, about the current state of the lake, about the current use of the land at the easement, is not relevant to what the intentions of the original parties to the easement were. And on summary judgment, if the movement seeking to get the declaration that they have a right to build a pier doesn't come forward with any relevant evidence, and the defendants in this case came forward with evidence that there was no pier on the land when the easement was first granted, and that there was no boat lift, no pier, and that the easement was intended to be used just to get to the lake, that evidence is undisputed. The Conachers haven't submitted any evidence in this on summary judgment to rebut the evidence of the intentions of the parties at the outset or shortly thereafter. If they're moving for summary judgment on something like this, they have the burden to develop the evidence and produce it that the historical use of the easement was to include a pier. In this case, it's notable because of the absence of that evidence and evidence from parties at the time of the original easement or other parties at that time that there was no pier on the property. And as the Court of Appeals noted, there's no evidence that there was any pier on the property for 23 years. These issues could be decided on summary judgment and are, and this case is just completely missing the kind of evidence that would support a holding that the easement granted the right to build a pier. And because the evidence on the other side is unrefuted, the evidence of the easement holders that they expected to give the right to build a pier and that they can't use the water for any other purpose, that isn't probative, that isn't relevant to the issue of what the original parties intended. So because the movement didn't supply evidence on the central issue on which they had the burden of proof, then granting summary judgment against the Conachers would have been appropriate as the Court of Appeals held. I think that was the gist of the Court of Appeals decision in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Sorenson?
Thank you, Chief Justice, other members of the court. Let me begin by taking to the most recent case that we have, which is the Wendt case that this court asked us to address. Let me look at paragraph 14 of that case. Therefore, we concluded Ellingsworth does not govern this case and that the parties' competing arguments as to whether summary judgment evidence satisfies the factors under Wisconsin Statute 30.131 are off the mark. The same is true as to the trial court's analysis. The issue here is not whether the pier is lawful under Wisconsin Statute 30.131. Yet that is a matter for the Department of Natural Resources. Rather, in our judgment, the proper inquiry is whether the terms and the purposes of the easement included the right to use and maintain the pier. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what the issue in this case is. This is not a case about Chapter 30.131. 30.131, again, I clearly want to point out to this court, was a reaction to a situation that was clarified because of the conflicts in the circuits with the creation of 30.133, which specifically then amended 131 to add the language, notwithstanding 30.133, which specifically denoted prospective view from the court. What the court was saying is we're not going to retroactively take away riparian rights. There is no question that riparian rights can be transferred. The case that counsel cites, the Cassidy case, makes it clear that riparian rights can be transferred. In that case, the court clearly points out that riparian rights are well defined in Wisconsin law, and the right now conditioned by the statute to construct a pier or similar structure in aid of navigation is one of those rights. We're not talking about riparian owners. Ellingsworth talks about riparian owners. Several of the cases cited by the council. Her argument talks about riparian owners. That's not the issue before the court. The court is, can you convey by easement a riparian right? Of course you can't convey ownership, but can you convey a right? And the court has said yes, because it is not a mutually exclusive right. Obviously, both parties can use that right, and they did.
Do you think all seven of the backlog owners can build a pier?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Do you think all seven of the owners who have the rights to the easement can build a pier?
I think they have the riparian right to build it. I think Chapter 30 will prevent seven piers from being constructed there. I'm very well acquainted with rotating piers, which is a way of life on the lake now when you have backlots that have riparian rights to piers. Interesting enough, Nelson's and Romano's share a pier on the lot. The lot we're talking about is an access lot that they own. Remember, one of the questions that came up earlier is, well, how come your client wasn't using this for a pier? Remember that it was rented for those, 23 years. They had a space. And in fact, for a period of time, as Justice Rogensack read from the affidavit, which I have, and if you go to the next paragraph, they talk about that same thing continuing. They used their access to get to the pier that was alongside their easement. Only when Conacher's came along and bought and they took away that right was there ever a necessity to put a pier in now, because now you don't have a place to put it. Rotation is the system which you use, and it's used all the time.
Was that pier that you just referred to, was that, and that was in the Nelson's affidavit?
That's correct.
Was that within the easement, or was it adjacent to the easement?
Well, again,
what does the evidence suggest?
Well, the evidence is exactly what Justice Rogan said, read. I mean, I know the answer to your question, but I'm not here to testify.
I know. The reason I even asked the question is I heard in your oration that it wasn't within the easement. It was adjacent to it, and they had to go on to the adjacent property to get to it. That's what I heard you say, and that's why I asked.
Excuse me. What I was talking about, Justice, is the next party, the Carlsons, who take over next, they moved the pier to the east. Carlsons had to walk out to get to that easement after they moved it to the east. And that was for navigation. A couple of quick points I want to point. Oh, I'm sorry.
Your time is up. Thank you very much, Mr. Sorensen, and thank you very much, Ms. Rant, for your arguments this morning on easements. Today is two-thirds easement days, and our next case has an easement issue.
We had one a couple of days ago. So thank you. And this concludes our hearing in 08-AP-1546, Conacher versus Romano. Thank you. The court will take a few moments in recess to allow these students to leave, and we have another group of students coming in. Thank you.